Welcome, everyone, to this edition of the Not So Common podcast. I have a guest this week, not Frank, but it's Adam Korlick. He's a YouTuber who's been doing it since 2009, has over 93,000 subscribers. He's big into video game commentary. He does things such as pickup videos, video game generation recaps, and even has a podcast. Look at that. Welcome, Adam. How's it going?
I'm good, man. Thanks for having me here. It's great to finally be on the show. You and I have talked about this for a while, actually.
That long? What was a while?
You first brought it up at AVGC last year.
Well, last year I did not have this podcast going at the time. Last year I just had the CU podcast.
True, but you mentioned just being on your podcast.
Oh, okay. Well, here you go.
As a generic term. But yeah, either way, it's good to be here.
You're a YouTuber that, I guess this is a positive, is that I didn't hear about you from really one video or one thing that stood out. It was sort of, I guess, underground or organic, where I just saw you pop up slowly but surely here and there, which I guess it goes to your credit of you, I guess, finding your niche and hitting your stride and keep plugging away at it. You know, you've been doing this for 8 years, nearly as long as I have. So why don't you tell me how you got started on YouTube? What got you into it?
So basically, I went to Columbia College Chicago for film school purposes, and I was directing a lot of short films at the time, and I thought, okay, I need a place to kind of host this, and that YouTube made a lot of sense, but I was like, well, nobody's going to see these because there's nobody following me, so I need to make some other content. I was like, well, what else do I know? I know video games, so I would make a lot of video game videos, specifically about the Dreamcast, and then that started building up a base, and then I started putting out the short films, and then it got to a point where I was like, well, the hell with the short films, I'll just make video game videos, and so that's what I'm doing now across four different channels now.
Four channels. What are your four different channels?
I work on a total of four channels. I have the one you mentioned, which is just my name, Adam Korlick. I also work on another channel called Game Society, formerly known as Game Society Pimps, which that one is about your size. That's like just shy of 500,000 subs.
That's bigger than mine.
Oh, it is. Oh, that's right. What are you at?
I'm like 225 about.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I for some reason I thought you were more like at 500,000. You'll definitely get there. And then I also do on this other one, another one called Blame Society Films. I work with them on a show called Beer and Board Games. They're best known for a show called Chad Vader that was like really popular. Like,
oh, okay, yeah, everyone's heard of that. Okay, so I didn't know you're involved with that.
I'm not only involved with it, I was crew, I'm in the show, I'm in episodes of that show. My buddy is the voice of Darth Vader for Lucasfilm now. I mean, other than James Earl Jones doing, like, Rogue One, when they do toys or video games, like, my buddy's the guy doing that. And then I also work on Machinima, and of course Machinima's like its own thing, you know, it's like, what, they're like 13 million subs or something like that, they're insane. But, I work across all four of those.
What do you do for Machinima?
So they have, we do a series for them that's basically celebrity impression comedy. It was known as the Christopher Walken through. Basically, the idea was, you know, a guy would voice Christopher Walken and play a video game, and it would seem like Christopher Walken's the one playing the video game. And then we started branching into other celebrities like Morgan Freeman, President Obama, President Trump, you know, and there's so many others that we would do because we have a professional voice impersonator actor who does that. And so we do those for the main channel a lot. But we've also done various projects for them that we filmed like on the Warner Brothers lot. And just the other day I got back from, you know, one of their parties up in Seattle at PAX West. Like, so, yeah, I have a lot of friends over at Machinima too.
So you are employed by them for that specific channel for those videos?
I wouldn't call it employment. They would call it contract work, but if you want to call it that, yeah.
But it's steady. It's regular. You help put out content on their channel.
That is correct.
I have heard of the – I mean, now you say it, I must have listened to one of the celebrity gaming ones at some point. That does sound familiar. Like Christopher Walken playing games. That does sound familiar. I probably have seen one years back. Obviously, Chad Vader was one of the biggest sort of early sort of YouTuber – you know, YouTube videos people got into. Did that end at some point? Did that finally end?
Yeah, there was a fourth season that came out a couple of years ago, and that's where it has stopped. There's always the possibility of some sort of return. That's certainly not my department. My buddy Aaron and my buddy Matt, that would be their decision. But there's, you know, they have interest in doing it at some point, potentially. But yes, there is a current end to the series.
So how do you have time to bounce between four different channels?
Oh, dude, it's impossible. So I work 7 days a week on YouTube content. When it comes to my personal channel, whenever I'm home, I typically have to, like, do an entire schedule for what my video catalog is going to be for the next couple of months and produce as many as I possibly can in that time frame. Because often I'm sent off to different places to do things for the other channels. I end up wearing a lot of different hats, like certain places I have to go to represent myself, such as ABGC, where you and I met and where we will be going soon very well. I have to represent myself. And then things like PAX West, which I just came from today at the time we record this, I'm there to represent Game Society. And then other things I have to sometimes be part of, like representing Machinima, and then sometimes I go to different conventions and represent Blame Society. So it's good to have other people on your team. So, but my channel, whenever I have to deal with it personally, it's just kind of, okay, I'm home for a bit. Let's just make as much content as I possibly can. And the other ones, often I have to bring content to the editing team and then let them deal with it.
So how long has YouTube been your full-time gig at this point?
I don't know if you'd call it my full-time gig, but I mean, I started doing it in 2009, and I guess maybe it was around 2011 that I thought, okay, let's try to do this as an actual career, or at least let's do this as a job. And then it just kind of morphed into a career as more opportunities came about.
So it was sort of a gradual sort of transition as you got more and more work, more and more channels you're working on. What were you doing before YouTube?
I was in college. I just went through 4 years of college, and before that, 4 years of high school, and so on and so forth. Like, I really didn't do anything in between there. It was pretty much just jump straight in, because, like I said earlier, my goal was to do film production, and the logical place to start was YouTube, just to try and build an audience.
What did you enjoy about filming? Like, what sort of short films did you have a specialty? Was it comedy, drama? What were you into?
So I kind of tried my hand at everything. I did a few comedies that do appear on my channel. They're kind of buried in the bowels of it. They show up, and you'll see my film degree every once in a while comes back for a cameo. But like, I did some horror films. I did an action film, some of which have aired and have been on the channel. Others have not. But the thing I'm most proud of that isn't exactly my film, but I kind of take credit for it, was I created Jurassic Park 1.5, and I created Back to the Future 4 and 5. And the way that worked is Telltale Studios, if you've heard of them, they made they got really big with like the Walking Dead game. But before they made that, they made Jurassic Park the game. They made Back to the Future the game, which was basically interactive cinema. So I took their games, I captured all the footage, and I edited them into like full-on feature films, like well beyond just, oh, I'm going to glue the cutscenes together. Like, there was a lot of work that went into that, to the point where that was where my film degree kind of popped up again. It was like, hey, remember how to do story structure? This is how you should organize this. And I actually got a letter from Telltale after Back to the Future 4, which is the only one of those three that got any kind of traction. I got a letter from Telltale basically thanking me for doing that, because they thought that was amazing. So like I said, The film degree still pops up. There's still that part of me who wants to make that kind of content. It's just that given current time constraints, like, you know, when the hell would I do that?
So you took all the cutscenes and all the story elements. Did you re-edit? Did you add a score to the background, little effects here and there? How did you, I guess, make it pop out?
I literally did all of those things. So the gameplay is there's a lot of cutscenes in it, but there's a lot of fetch questing. You know, there's a lot of like, hey, let's go from this spot to go figure out the puzzle to come right back to this spot. And you can't do that in a movie. That's not interesting. So you have to find creative ways to compile all the scenes to get all the essential information out and make sure that it still flows as an actual film scene. As for scores, you can't use the actual original Back to the Future music, because that's, you know, I'm sure you know this well, YouTube content ID bots would be all over that. So you have to actually go after other types of music that sound very similar, which was a pain in the ass. But fortunately, Telltale actually created a lot of those assets themselves, and they don't care if you use it. I did a lot of stuff like that, and I'm very proud of that project. And to YouTube's credit, every once in a while, they throw Back to the Future 4 back into the algorithm. And I'm happy about that, because at least people get to see it. Like, I never needed it to make, like, I didn't need it to get, like, a bazillion views. I don't need it to make tons of money or anything like that. It's just one of those things where I just want fans of it to be able to see it. And so I'm glad it exists there.
So the life of a YouTuber, you're saying, online content creator, you said you're working 7 days a week.
Yeah.
So almost no time off. I mean, I'm getting you right now. I'm talking to you while you're in a hotel room.
That is correct.
you just did PAX West. You're going out to what? You're seeing a preview of a game. Is that correct? Is that what you're doing tomorrow?
So here's my schedule as of right now. On August 31st, I flew out to Seattle, Washington for PAX West for media purposes. And I was there until today, which is September 5th. I flew straight from there down here to San Francisco. And I'm now going to be in San Francisco for 3 days to cover a totally different media event. Then, after that's over, on the 7th, I fly home for one night in which I have to edit all the stuff I shot at PAX West. And then I fly out to see you the next day for 3 days at a convention. And that's just within the next, like, week and a half.
At some point, do you feel like I can't do this any longer? I need a break. Do you take vacations at all? Do you get burnt out? How do you deal with the sort of rush you're going through?
A lot of Starbucks double shot espressos as I sit here and drink one. I literally bought four right before this podcast.
Oh my God, I'm gonna get you hopped up for this.
Fantastic. At this point, it's just basic fuel, man.
So what's the event you're doing tomorrow? If you may,
It is that. Yeah. It's a preview event for South Park: The Fractured But Whole.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So it'll be cool. It's actually the third time I will have played it. But I'm sure there's gonna be more content. I'll know tomorrow. And then I can, you know, basically get early access to the game and make footage out of it. And that's when we'll do one of those like celebrity impression type of videos usually. And that'll appear over on my other channel, Game Society.
Okay, so that's for Game Society, not your personal channel.
Correct. Okay. Like I said, I wear multiple hats. So at some events, I'm me. Some events, I'm a different guy. You know what I mean? Like, people know you for different things.
So how many people is involved with Game Society Pimps? How big is that team?
Technically, it's three people. But there's the actor who I keep mentioning is not actually part of it necessarily. He's more of like an actor. But at the same time, we kind of consider him part of it, so officially three, unofficially four, and then we have an extra editor who lives out in Pittsburgh, who his name is Lucas, and every once in a while he gets involved. So you can go as high as five and as low as three. It's debatable though.
And you have one person that oversees the general management, even though you have multiple people working on it at the same time.
I would say that everyone has to wear multiple hats. So we have two guys that edit, two guys that manage. And I like one guy, he does like half editing and half management. I do like full management, and we have one guy who does all editing. And then we have a guest editor, and then we have a voice actor. And at the same time, two of them have to do most of the acting. I have to do some acting every once in a while for certain shows like Disneyland Adventures, because I voice Stitch and I voice Mickey Mouse. And so they appear in these shows that are very vulgar, and it would destroy your childhood if you ever heard them. We did this series on a game called Disneyland Adventures for the Xbox 360, which is a Kinect game. So, you know, all right off the bat, it really doesn't work. And you basically, the whole premise was, it was a kid's game where you just kind of wander around Disneyland and you have to go on all the rides, but try to use the Kinect for them. And it doesn't work at all. And so the whole series was basically me playing as Stitch and Mickey Mouse, making my friend go through unbelievable hell. Like, he's a slave trapped at the park and he has to complete all these objectives. And the series has done really well, and like to the point where people just absolutely love it. But it kind of ran out of content. And now, for whatever reason, I don't know if you saw this at Gamescom, Microsoft announced they're basically like re-releasing it in like Xbox One High Definition Remastered Edition. And we're like, of all the things that you could have re-released, you chose a Kinect game. And so, yeah, so Mickey Mouse will make his friends suffer once more. It'll be wonderful.
So what is Disney going to – well, that's actually – yeah, Disney own everything, right? They own Mickey Mouse. They own Star Wars. They own Marvel. When are they going to pick you up as a side actor then for that voice?
I don't think that – I think if they ever listened to mine, they would never accept me. My audition tape would be nothing but Mickey saying horrible things about the Disney Corporation and like, the things I don't actually feel, but that my my Mickey Mouse is evil, man. He is evil. It's like Stitch.
The great South Park version of Mickey Mouse where he just beats the hell out of everyone with a baseball bat.
Yeah, I get compared to that a lot.
Probably one of the finest moments on South Park. Mickey Mouse finally shows up and he's like a gangster just destroying people. You know, I'm surprised Disney didn't come after Matt and Trey for that. That was just one of the most hysterical things. Or maybe they had a nice sense of humor about it. So you're into some retro game stuff.
Yeah, a little bit.
On your channel, you do video game pickups. You've done these very interesting freeform generation recap videos. Tell me about those first. How did you think of those?
Okay, so yeah, that's what you're referencing as these videos where I basically just talk about any console, and I talk about its history, and I talk about its impact and stuff, and my experience with it. Really, where that started was when the seventh generation ended, and the eighth generation started with the Wii U, the Xbox One, and PS4 had finally come out. I thought it would just be kind of interesting to just talk about the seventh gen consoles, the 360, the Wii, the PS3, and just do exactly that, just talk a little bit about it, and I never really thought it would go anywhere. And at the end of it, everyone was like, you got to do this more. I want to see all the sixth gen consoles, do all those. And I thought, okay, I have them. I guess I could do that. So I did it. And then at the end of it, people kept saying, do the fifth gen. So I thought, all right, I'll do that. And it just kept going that way until I'm already done with the second generation. And a lot of people say, like, can you do the first gen? And I'm like, it's all Pong clones. Like, there's really nothing to do.
Odyssey 1.
Exactly. That's the only interesting one. And I don't own it, so I can't do it. I could do one video that has all the Pong clones I own in one video and be like, guys, this one game was popular, so every console company made it. But, like, aside from that, there's not much to do. There's also handhelds, which I've never tackled, but at this point now, it's more about the time. Because when I was doing most of those videos, I didn't get shipped off to different cities and different countries for different things all the time. Now I do. So, like, logistically speaking, I have to actually plan ahead for something like that, and I'm never really sure when that's going to work.
So yeah. you had the background in retro games going way back to, in order to even talk about some esoteric consoles.
Yes.
So you were following this for years before it blew up and got popular. Retro.
Yeah, definitely. I said, I'm kind of OG with YouTube, much like yourself. Like, 2009 makes us original gangster, by the way, which is kind of creepy. But I'm of the same philosophy. I've just really liked retro gaming. I love following it, love learning about it. And, you know, I was actually watching a lot of other YouTubers and their content. I thought, this is, you know, kind of exciting. It would be kind of cool to do something like this. And then when I eventually realized I should be making videos for reasons previously stated, that's just kind of where I went with it. It was always a passion of mine. I've always had, like, a soft spot for really the failed consoles, the ones that we always perceive as failures, the ones that don't get a whole lot of coverage. I mean, there's only so many times you can watch some guy's review of the PS1 before you're like, I don't think there's much else I don't know about this thing. But when somebody's like, today, guys, we're going to talk about the Amiga CD32, you're like, all right, I don't know shit about that. Let's talk. What is that?
I never turned mine on, I don't think. Mine's sitting in the game.
You have one?
Yeah, I have one.
Oh, the European or Canadian?
It must be a Canadian one. I know they weren't released in the U.S., so it must be. I bought it in the U.S. at actually Super Collector. It's funny. Super Collector Steve Lin gave me one at Classic Game Fest 2012 in Vegas, but he didn't have a controller, right? And the controllers are really hard to find. They're expensive. And so he gave that to me, and then I remember I picked up some games somewhere, like 10 or 12 games. And then, so I didn't have a controller for like 2 or 3 years later. Then he gave me a controller or gave me a good deal on a controller way later. So it took me like 4 years to piece together my Amiga CD32. And I don't think I've still played it. It's just one of those things where, if you collect retro games and consoles, so you know that sometimes you just don't have time to go through this stuff. You just don't. You just sort of compile it. And I wish there was a time where I can just sit down and say, okay, let me actually turn on my Atari, 800 finally. Let me play my Amiga CD32 and finally just go to it. And I guess eventually I will, but I haven't done it yet.
I can relate to that so hard. It's scary. Like, trust me, I get that. Like, when am I going to sit down and play my Apple Pippin? Realistically, never.
Well, that's one I don't have. I don't have the Pippin. it's like a trade.
There's really not much of a reason to play it. my favorite game on it is Power Rangers Zeo, just because I can't believe it exists. But everyone says Marathon. There's a port of Marathon that's pretty good. But, like, aside from that, there's really nothing on there. And I'm just like, yeah, but it's cool. It exists. Apple made a console, and it's technically the most powerful fifth-generation console. It actually puts to shame the N64, but nobody knows that. Because why would you know that? Why would you even know it exists? And it's just – I find stuff like that fascinating.
That's where I'm training towards in my game collecting life. The twilight of my retro collecting career is just weird, esoteric stuff. I can't say what I just picked up recently because it's going to appear in a future video. But I just picked up something just I'm like, oh, it's not really worth a huge amount, but no one knows about it. Like that sort of thing. That's really what I'm sort of, you know, sort of honing in on because it's like at this point, I have so many games, it sort of defeats the purpose. If I already have a ton of games I'm never going to get around to play, what's the point of adding 1,000 more to that collection? I'm just sort of slowing down in terms of just picking up any game I don't have. It's just select titles, select weird stuff, weird-ass Nintendo accessories. I picked up a weird Nintendo accessory recently that's I've seen like twice in my life loose, and I found one in the box. You know, just stuff like that. I'm going to have Ben Heck try and hopefully fix one of my Nintendo peripherals that's extremely rare, that's broken. You know, just stuff like that. I feel like I'm... Maybe you're the same way, trending towards the preservation part of retro game collecting.
I'm actually 100% there with you. I can relate to that. Like, it gets to a point where you're just like, do I really need to get a whole other box of PlayStation 2 games? Is that necessary? I don't know if it is. You know what I mean? Like, so, like, I'm getting into the twilight, as that's a good term for it, of what stuff I want to try and get complete sets of. And then after that, it has to just be like oddball items. So that's why I care less about, I guess now, this is going to sound bad to any gamer out there, but I'm starting to care less about the games and more about the oddball consoles, like the Apple Pippin. Like, it's cool to own one, but I don't really care how many games I ever get for it, because realistically, probably never going to play it. But I still want to find stuff like that because, yeah, I want to preserve it. I want to make sure it's safe, essentially. But any, like, interesting game, yeah, sure, you want to pick that up. But after that, yeah, oddball items. I'm with you 100%.
Yeah, I think one of the oddball system I picked up was, you can find a ton of new old stock, the Chinese N64, the IQ.
Oh, yeah, I've held one of those once.
There's a ton of ones on eBay that are brand new you can buy, so it's not like they're hard to get. I mean, they must have just had, like, a warehouse full of them and never sold them, you know. So it's just one of those weird things where it's probably most likely trash, but it's just so weird to see a Chinese system at all during that time period, let alone one with Mario on the box for it, you know. So, you know, it is what it is. I mean, when I talk to certain collectors, they're more trying to, you know, help out museums, donate their really rare stuff to places like the Video Game History Museum, you know, or the Museum of Strong Museum of Play, places like that. And I know that, you know, I talk to people like John Hancock who are really looking into potentially opening up their own little museums in their corner of the world. And I can see myself maybe doing that in my future. Maybe there's a place in Southern California for game collections and oddities of video game history, and maybe I do that at some point. Because otherwise, it just sits in a room, collects dust. The rare games sit in a bank vault that no one ever sees. And, you know, what's the point? I don't want to be one of those collectors that just sort of has all my rarities tucked away just for my personal gain and I guess, false self-worth. I'd rather share them at some point. You know, it's like they're not doing any good sitting there. They're just not. And it's almost depressing to think about because it's almost like I want to fast-forward the process of getting some of the stuff out there.
You know, it's weird you mention that because those kinds of same thoughts have gone through my head many times about what if I died? Like, what if I try to go home, you know, my plane crashes or whatever? Like, who's going to take care of that stuff? Who's going to make it go somewhere useful? Because I don't want it to just be thrown away or whatever. So I'm with you in the logical sense of like, I always kind of, part of having a collection like that is wanting other people to see it and to celebrate it in a sense. And a museum is a very good way to do that. But then you get into the same position I'm sure you're in, which is like, I'm cool with a museum. I guess I have control over where it's mine, but the idea of just donating, you know, who knows how much stuff to something that you don't control seems kind of weird. So in a sense, like you're basically saying like you want your own museum, and I guess I'm somewhat of the same boat.
Sure, because I don't think there's going to be... I don't need the money for my collection. I don't. I'm fortunate enough where I got to a point... I went from quitting my job 5 years ago, and you probably started off someplace similarly, where like when you first started doing YouTube more and more, you weren't really making that much from it. Well, I was in the workforce for a long time, and it beat the hell out of me. You know, working 50, 55-hour work weeks, making decent money, but high stress, working, you know, some Saturday mornings, and, you know, you're not getting a bonus for it, and it's just more piled on work. So at least when I went from that to making maybe, I don't know, $1,000 a year, and blip in YouTube revenue. You know what I mean? Like, at least at that point, I was controlling my own destiny, and if it was any stress, I was putting it on myself, right? So, but the good news is that, like, I'm not in the position, like, maybe you asked me 5 years ago about selling off some of my collection, potentially because I needed the money. I could have maybe seen selling off part of it, but now I don't have to. I'm fortunate enough that I've been successful enough that, you know, my collection, the collection's value doesn't mean a thing to me. I mean, it never really meant that much to me, but now it definitely doesn't mean anything to me. You know, it could be worth 25 cents. But the whole point is, I think that's where eventually a lot of this stuff's going to trend to. I think that there might be one last generation of retro game collectors that comes up after us. But really, I don't think we're going to be replaced. I think 50 years from now, all this stuff that's laying around is going to be looked at as sort of relics of old, you know, old media that doesn't exist in any form anymore. It's just going to be like, oh, look at this interesting stuff. Like looking at the, you know, the old original phonograph cans from the early 1900s. If you saw like the Edison, you know, the Edison Museum in New Jersey, where it's like, oh, that's interesting. There's a couple of whack jobs out there that probably have a phonograph that can play those, but otherwise, they're just relics that don't matter anymore. And I think we're going to see that for a majority of these retro game collections. And I know there's a bunch of collectors out there that want to strangle me because they think that's going to be their nest egg 30 years from now when they retire. But I'm not sure that's going to be the case. That's just my personal opinion on it. You shouldn't count on it to retire off of.
You know what? I really wish I didn't agree with you, but...
It's depressing, right?
It is. Like, because I hate to say it, but I don't think you're wrong. I mean... You present an interesting point. There probably will be one, maybe even two generations beyond us. Generation being, you know, people within a 20, 30 year bracket. But after that, yeah, I mean, you're right. Nobody really cares about early 19th century technology except for a museum that has like one or two pieces. And you look at it for half a second when you're in there, like, oh, that's interesting. And you move on. Like we all are aware of the original Edison light bulb, but would any of us really care to try and use one now? Probably not. And
my grandfather had a player piano. Sorry to cut you off. My grandfather had a player piano. He collected the rolls. You know, you put the roll in, it plays automatically. The keys move. Mm-hmm. Really cool. He had problems. He found a buyer for the player piano, went to some like saloon that like fashioned itself as an old style old west saloon somewhere in the Midwest or West. But he had problems giving away those player piano rolls. And while there probably were some that were worth money, the problem is how many people out there are collecting player piano rolls from like the, you know, the 30s and 40s? Like how many people are actually doing that? You know, and I'm not saying – obviously, there's a lot more people interested in retro video games. What I'm saying is, though, everything eventually hits a sort of a peak for number of collectors out there. You know, I just think that's going to be the same thing for what we're doing right now. I just do.
Yeah. I'm sad to say that I agree with you.
So sell all your retro game collections right now, everyone who wants to cash out.
Blow up the market. We'll get them all cheap. That's our evil plan.
But that's what's funny though, because the last people that get into collecting in a scene are usually the first ones out. At least from what I've seen, the last ones in are usually the ones that fall because they see it's hot, it's something cool, I can spend money on it. Maybe there's some collectible value. Not necessarily meaning they're in for the money 100%, but those are the ones that usually follow the trend. But they're the first ones that get out when they see the value dipping or the interest waning. So I liken the whole thing. This is probably the second or third time bringing this up to. Toy trains, how those were pretty freaking big 30 years ago to 35 years ago. My father collected trains. There were train shows a lot when I grew up, when I was like five. I grew up in the 80s. I'm probably older than you. And train shows were pretty common back then. You go somewhere, you see the big sets set up. And these were people that at that point, you know, they were in their 30s and 40s and 50s because they grew up with trains in the 40s and 50s as a kid. And then when they went back and were collecting the old Lionel stuff and whatever other companies were doing them, you'd be hard pressed to find a train show anymore. Like, you really, like, think about the last time you saw an advertiser. If you did, you probably showed up, there'd be maybe 50 people there that showed up to a train show. You know, think about all those model train shops that used to exist that don't anymore.
No, you're absolutely right. I had an uncle who was way into that, so he tried to push that on me as a kid, and I liked it. I did. I actually did like that as a kid, but then I reached an age where I was like, all right, I guess I'm good. And there was actually this model train store, and I remember we used to go there and find stuff, but you know, they didn't last very long. You know what kept them alive was a big phase where yo-yos were popular, where they were making their money. as weird as that sounds, then they went out of business, you know, like, and so, yeah, I agree with you. There's just some stuff that it's got a very defined age, even at the height of its popularity. There's only so long it's going to be able to last because the generation that it was cool to does eventually die.
Sure. And something like comic books translates more easily generation to generation with the movies and the fact that comics is also artwork at the same time. I think that's lost in some people that like to try to compare old comic books to video games, is that you can look at a comic book any time you're there and you can appreciate it just for it being artwork in and of itself. And you can hang it up even if you have that old comic slabbed and graded. There's something to be said for that. It's sort of it's also almost like an artifact of pop culture. You know, looking back at a comic from the Silver Age or Golden Age. Yeah, 50 years from now, will people be able to say the same thing about Super Mario Brothers on the NES? Sure, except there's a billion Super Mario Brothers NES cartridges as opposed to not as many copies of, you know, Action Comics number 1 from 1939.
I was going to say exactly the same reference. I'm like, there's maybe 10 copies of Action Comics number 1, you know, with Superman on the cover. And, you know, the only ones, I mean, I don't pretend to be like an expert on comics, but I'll tell you right now, the oldest ones, the ones that, unless they're autographed or something by Stan Lee or whatever, the only ones that are likely valuable are like the first legit Superman one, Action Comics number 1. And then, like, the first issue with Batman, the first issue with Spider-Man, and so on.
Yeah, like key issues.
Yeah, key issues, exactly. The best-case scenario with video games is some Mario or Sonic game if, you know, like, somehow most of the copies in the world were destroyed. Like, that's about it. Like, because you're right. There's way too many Sonic games. There's way too many Mario games. There's way too many copies of all the ones that are iconic. And then obscure ones, in my opinion, the obscure ones that are currently expensive will become less expensive because they'll become too obscure for their own good. No one will care anymore.
Sure, that's always my argument about Steam events, for example. It's rare now, and it's valuable now because people know about it. But 50 years from now, what will a game like Steam events present itself as? Just an oddity of game history that means something for Nintendo collectors now, but 50 years from now it may not mean a thing. At that point, you might have a much more common game, maybe like a sealed original Super Mario Brothers, which one just sold for, what was it just sold for?
It was like 36,000, wasn't it? Something like that?
It wasn't even the first print. It was the second print. That's right.
Oh,
it wasn't even
the
sticker seal one. And that sold for a ton of money. That might be what people are looking for. Or maybe Nintendo World Championships always maintains its value. And I say that obviously having, owning it. But I think that's a possibility just because there's a piece of, history there. But yeah, it's interesting to collect games. So what are you into collecting most? Besides the, is there a system you gravitate towards? Dreamcast,
well,
for example.
Yeah. Hey, what do you know? What a setup. So yeah, my favorite of all time was the Sega Dreamcast, and that's I went hard after that, and I did it in like the 2008 economic crash. So it was actually really easy because nobody gave a crap about Dreamcast stuff right then.
I would argue most people still don't. Most collectors still probably don't care.
Dreamcast stuff is stupid hard to get now. Like, really hard. Yeah, Dreamcast stuff is actually really, really hard. It's very hot right now amongst collectors to try and get Dreamcast stuff. Good luck to you if you try it, because most stores, they like, nah, we have the sports games maybe, and like that's it. Like, nobody ever has it in stock.
Is that because people have found a system that maybe it started off really cheap and then they just sort of glommed onto that?
Yeah, that's part of it. It's also, you know, the fact that it is Sega's last console, like, definitively. Like, they'll never do another one, you know, so it's nice to get a full set. And the set is also reasonably small. If you're doing North America, it's 248 games, so it's not really impossible. Now, what I did is I got the full North American set, then I got all the European exclusives, which was like 24 additional games, and then all the Japanese games, all the Japanese exclusives, which was an additional like 400 titles, something like that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that one was a little bit harder, but I did manage to pull that off. I get still the new titles that come out, the independent Dreamcast games, as well as a lot of the third-party just random stuff like Bleemcast that popped up, you know, stuff like that. And I got a whole bunch of accessories and console variations. I have a whole bunch of development hardware for the Dreamcast that I've acquired over the years, as well as like the Divers 2000 Dreamcast, which was a Japanese television that looks like an old iMac, and it has a Dreamcast built into it. And it was like designed to be a physical iteration of Skype, as weird as that might sound. Like, the idea was, like, you know, you're going to buy this TV, you're going to put it in your house, and you're going to load this basically this camera software, and it comes with a webcam, and it has a modem built in. Everyone is going to have these. They're going to be stupid popular. You'll put it in every room in your house, and you'll be able to just call each other all over the house, all over the world. It's physical Skype. Didn't work at all. They only made, like, 200 of them, supposedly. But I ended up with one. Again, in like 2008 when no one cared. Now, I mean, I bought it for like $300 with shipping from Japan. Now there's one on eBay. The last one that sold was like $6,500.
What is it called again?
The Divers, as in swimming. Divers 2000 Dreamcast.
Let me look this up. I don't think I've seen one of these. And how many of these did they actually make?
Supposedly 200.
200?
Yeah.
Say it's a wacky looking TV. Wow.
Yeah, isn't it?
It's a blue... 1950s looking TV with antenna on it.
Those are purely cosmetic. They do not do a damn thing.
Oh, yeah. So someone wants $2,000 for one.
No, someone wants $6,500 for one.
Okay, I'm looking at one right now. Someone wants $2,000 US for a loose one. Another one is selling one for $5,400 best offer in the box, never used.
That must have come down because I did a video on it a few months ago, and that was at the time they wanted like $6,500 and stuff. But I'm glad it came down.
Well, how many people are going to be spending that much money on that? I guess so. It has to come down at some point.
Yeah, exactly. Just like all collectibles.
Oh, now it's on sale for $5,000. It's on sale for 7% off for $5,000.
Well, you should just pull the trigger. Just go for it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Don't even think about it. Don't even think about it. Just do it. Buy it right here live on the podcast.
Yeah, I don't have time to play my Amiga CD32, but I'll buy this Divers 2000 Dreamcast
TV. Yeah, you should do it, man.
I guess I always thought Dreamcast was somewhat easier to collect for because at least when I was finding out the swap meet, no one cared about them.
Yeah, but when was that?
Well, I don't know, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, maybe. I mean, I own, let's see how many games I own. I own 105 games, and I probably bought 99 of those or 100 of those from the flea market, I think. Then again, I'm trying to see how many are ones that are probably hard to find. I'm not a Dreamcast expert, so I'm not positive. What are some of the hard to find ones?
Ironically, you're not asking a good person for this because I finished the set so long ago that I stopped paying attention to what's rare and what isn't. I know Sonic Adventure Limited Edition is the hardest North American title to find because it was only sold at Blockbuster and Hollywood Video. It was just a rental. It was kind of like Clay Fighter Sculptor's Cut for the N64. It's kind of like that. That one's the hardest one to find. But there's, you know, some of the other ones that, from what I remember, Project Justice was kind of hard to find. Some of the Giga Wing games. A lot of stuff Capcom made is actually hard to find. And then there's always the dumb sports title that no one can find is NBA Hoops. You know, is never around. But, yeah, you'd have to ask someone who's actually actively collecting Dreamcast right now because, like I said, I finished.
You got them so long ago, you can just pick them off of eBay easily, basically. You can say, okay, I'll pick up that one. There wasn't much competition for people that were going for full sets at the time.
No, not back when I did that. That has been a recent thing.
Oh, okay. So this is basically where I think TurboGrafx sort of picked up steam about 4 years ago, where people finally decided, oh, these are worth money. Oh, this is interesting. That's probably what I would compare it to, most likely. I was lucky enough to complete my collection. I still need 3 CD games, but they're so expensive, no one else really goes after them. But I finished my North American Hue card set before most people even knew the system existed. So I was lucky to get in and out of that before that.
Yeah, that's a really apt comparison. That's pretty much exactly how it went down. Because I'm like you. I remember when TG16 was this obscure thing no one had ever even heard of, wasn't even sure it was real.
Because
TurboGrafx-16 was always the console. Like, when I was growing up, I believe I am younger than you. I grew up mostly in the 90s, so I'm 30 currently. But when I was a kid, when it was all Genesis versus SNES, there was always some kid who always claimed he knew a guy who had a TurboGrafx-16, but nobody ever really saw one or knew what it was. But I did. And I remember a phase there. Like, I bought one at a store for $24, and it came with 10 games, and one of them was Splatterhouse. And I actually did a video on it at the time. I opened it up. I cleaned it up. I did a video showing, like, hey, guys, here it is, sealed. Here's the price tag. And nobody knew what it was. And then now it's weird to think years later, people go back to watch that to clean the video, and they're like, how the hell did you get that for $24? It's like, I don't know. It was worthless a few years ago. Now everybody wants it. Yeah,
like about 12 years ago, 13 years ago, sure, no one cared about it. The CD system was maybe like $60, $70 then. I only had one myself because I won it in a newspaper contest, local newspaper contest. So I owned one, and the rich kid whose parents literally won the lottery across town that my friend Joey was friends with, he had one. But other than that, I knew no one else that had one. So I only owned about six games for it. And then there was one place on the East Coast called, it was a regional mom and pop rental store for movies and games called Easy Video. And they actually had one store that you could rent TurboGrafx games. So, cause as a kid, I remember playing Dragon Spirit on Turbo, but I was always in my head. I'm like, but I didn't own that game. So how did I play it? And I was like, oh, I remembered I rented it. You know, it's one of the few times I rented a Turbo game. But that's so foreign to people to think about something like that, renting a system like that out.
Yeah, you know, now that you mention it, you're right. I can't think of any store I ever went to in my life that rented TurboGrafx-16 games, ever.
I'm pretty sure it was that, because I don't remember renting it for the NES. I specifically remember playing the TurboGrafx version of the game as a kid, but I couldn't remember. But I didn't own it. I guarantee you I didn't own it. I owned mostly the common games. Vigilante, World Class Baseball, TV Sports Hockey, Taking It to the Hoop, Legendary Axe.
You just described half my collection.
Exactly. All the ones that when I go to the swap meet, I don't go as much as I used to, but you know, I'll find a TurboGrafx-16 and some games like once every 2 years, maybe. And at the time, you'll find eight or nine games with it. There was an earlier Flea Market Madness where I scored a TurboGrafx with about 10, 12 games. And half of those games are always the same. Then you throw in Bonk and maybe a Splatterhouse that are in there. But as a kid, I had one of the worst games ever, Battle Royale, which didn't come out in Japan because they had the real games, the real wrestling games, Fire Pro Wrestling. And we got trash like Battle Royale. Yeah, but anyway, that's a tangent. That was a bad purchase as a kid. That was a bad decision. Getting that. Oh man. Anyway, we're gonna see each other in New Jersey again. So what do you enjoy about these conventions when you go out to them? What do you end up doing at these?
It depends what kind of event we're talking about. But if we're talking about like the convention you and I are going to, those are fun because I like to meet people who actually watch my channel specifically. I like to meet the viewers, and you know, if they ever want photos or sign stuff or whatever, that's always great. But it's also good to just meet up with other people that I only ever get to see, such as you. I only get to see you at conventions like that. And then, you know, there's always the shopping element to it, although that has kind of lost some of its magic because of reasons we've stated throughout this, which is, you know, you're kind of getting to an end game. So that's not as awesome anymore. So mostly it's just the social interaction aspect.
Taking pictures, shaking hands, kissing babies, maybe buying some overpriced Dreamcast games that are around.
I don't need to buy the Dreamcast games there.
Do you also buy all the wacky Dreamcast accessories? Are you into those as well?
I have a bunch of them, and every once in a while I do find one that I did not know existed, and I pick it up. Like, literally, I did that a couple of days ago. I was in Seattle. I went to Pink Gorilla. I don't know if you're familiar with that chain.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah. So my buddy, Kelsey Lewin, she actually runs the store. And so I was hanging out with her for a bit, and I was just looking at stuff, and I saw that she had this random Dreamcast memory card I've never seen before by some company I'd never even heard of. And I was like, I'm buying this. I have to get this, because I was just like, I've never seen it. But because that's very rare to me to find any sort of Dreamcast stuff that I do not own and have never seen.
Sure, that's like me. In TurboGrafx, I pick up any wacky-ass accessory I can find. Like, they had Sega ones as well. They had gamer gloves. They had, like neon gloves you wore. And so when I saw them, I was like, oh my god, I've never seen these before. I have to buy them. I almost don't care about the price. You know, I gotta pick it up. For Nintendo, for 8-bit NES, it's a little bit tougher, just because I still find controllers and accessories I haven't seen before year after year, just because there was probably hundreds released and many were probably regional or had very limited distribution. So you find these knockoff ones that, hell, they could have released them in, you know, mid-90s in some areas, that it's hard to track them all down. You know,
yeah,
so that's something that I don't have to buy them all, but I usually snap a picture on my phone when I see them.
I do not envy you for being that into the NES, because that's got to be painful. Like, the amount of stuff that you have to pursue for that.
Most peripherals of any console, probably by a factor of 10, at least.
Yeah, that's...
The number of controllers was absolutely insane.
I believe it. And then you got all sorts. I don't know how much you care about, you know, the imports and stuff, but like not just Europe or Japan, but you know, like random stuff only released in like Brazil. You know, like that's got to be astronomically hard to do with the NES.
Yeah, for the I guess semi bootleg releases or regional releases, I don't get into those as much. I mean, I don't even get into collecting. What the hell are they called? God, I'm so tired. I can't think of them. Shit. The Sachin games, which were, you know, basically commercially available by mail order in the late 90s here. They're one step above pirate carts, and they're hard to find. I think a full set of sealed ones went on eBay. It's like 50 plus games went for like 6,000 or 7,000 about a month ago. And I'm not even to those. I'm more into like the mainstream releases. I start with North America, then I'll, you know, go over to Europe. And then if there's some Japanese stuff I like, I'll probably do that. You have to draw a line at some point. Otherwise, you run out of space, you run out of money.
Dude,
you
know, it's
like, I don't, yeah.
It's so creepy, like, how much you and I think alike on this type of thing. Like, literally down to, like, well, here's my rules. I'll start with North America, then I'll do Europe, and if possible, I'll tackle Japan.
Yeah. So, like, I'm missing – I think I need, like, 8 of the European NES exclusives. I'm missing only 3 North American. And for Famicom games – if it's something kind of weird or unique or kind of funny, I'll pick it up if it's cheap, but I'm not going to pursue it. Like I got, for example, on the Famicom, I got that gold, the gold punch out, the giveaway one that there's not many of. Like I pick up something like that. That's, I think, interesting, but I'm not going to go out and get like every single Japanese exclusive. I'm not going to go get the, you know, whatever, how many there are, 600, 700, you know, Japanese exclusive. It's just not worth my time or energy to do that. You know, and plus half it's shovelware games I can't play anyway, mm-hmm. or frickin' Mahjong games that Ian might like, but I don't want to play. You know, it's just those sort of things.
Have you been to Japan?
No, I haven't, but I gotta get out there.
Yeah, you should. So I was there earlier this year, and even I was tempted to pick up a bunch of Famicom stuff. And I got some. I was with a buddy of mine who lives out there, and he was telling me, like, these are the good ones, these are worth it, blah, blah, blah. And I'm telling you, Japan will break you mentally as a collector because you will see things you've never seen before. You will see oddballs you cannot resist, and you'll be like, you're just immersed in all these amazing things that to you are crazy imports. And over there, they're, like, dirt cheap.
Oh, yeah.
And you can't help yourself. I ended up going with a suitcase. I came back with a second suitcase. I advise anybody who goes there, go with 2 suitcases minimum.
I'm sure there's like Famicom games they're like giving away for like worth like, you know, $1 each.
Oh,
like
a tub, dude, of them. There was much less. You go to like a book off or whatever, they'll have like giant tubs of Famicom games that are like 99 yen a piece, which is about 80 cents. And you're just like this. You look the game up. It's like $10 on eBay. You're like, I don't even know what to do right now. Like you can't control yourself. It's weird. So good luck to you. Good luck to you if you ever go over there. It's brutal. It's absolutely brutal.
Yeah, I think I probably would probably do my best to stay for like PC Engine stuff and things that are probably more interesting versus, you know, like I said, 500 RPGs or Mahjong games I can't play that are worthless. Yeah, and you can't go by eBay prices for this stuff because these are like import prices.
I know, but it's just one of those things. It just messes with your head when you see how much other people are paying for it. And then you're like, but it's right here, and it's nothing.
Yeah, like I would go for like Konami Exciting Boxing if I saw it there. Like the one that had the punching bag. Like something like that I would go for if I could find it. Or like a weird accessory. Or they had like the Wild Gunman revolver light gun that didn't come out here. You know, I would probably go for something like that if I found it. You know, but yeah, I know you got to be careful. Like you have to. I have people that send me stuff they find there every now and then. And sometimes, like, yeah, this stuff is just, you can find it all over. It's not that much money. But here, I don't want it, but I'll send it to you. And it's like, oh, thanks a lot. You know, but at some point, you just don't have the space for, you know, 700 Japanese games. You know,
Yeah, trust me. I can relate.
How often do you go out to Japan?
Oh, I've only been there once. This year, I was there for 2 weeks, and I want to go back bad. Bad.
What did you end up doing out there?
So mostly it was just to spend time with my girlfriend and just kind of go to Japan because I just always had wanted to go. And while we stayed in Osaka primarily, a little bit of time up in Kyoto, and, you know, in the downtime, I guess we just mostly went to stores and just checked stuff out, you know, because She wanted to check out all sorts of, like, mostly Star Wars figures that only came out in Japan, and I wanted to check out, of course, video games in addition. Like, that's how we do vacations. You know, it's not, we're going to go do, like, oh, we're going to go see all the touristy sites. It's like, nah, we'll go take our required photo of the Osaka Castle. Now let's find a book off. You know, like, that was the plan. So I know that sounds like we went to Japan just to buy video games. That's not true. It was our vacation, but it's like, what are we going to do while we're here? That's what we're doing. So that was a lot of fun, but yeah, mostly it was just stuff like that. It was great, dude. My biggest score there was a GameCube, which doesn't sound like it would be that insane, but it's, I was in one book off and I saw just a white GameCube and I was like, I don't remember a white GameCube. And I looked it up and like, there was a European white GameCube. It's not really worth much. And there's a Japanese one. The Japanese one was a Final Fantasy Crystal Chronicles bundle set that was, it was only given away, as like a contest prize. 150 of them were produced. A boxed one is sold for about $3,000, a used one for about $1,000. This store had it labeled at $27 US. So I bought it and did a couple videos on it. And that was my ultimate score over there because it was like, holy shit. Like, I really walked away with one there.
It was in good, decent shape. Did it have a controller with it?
It had the controller. It had the Game Boy Player. It had the Game Boy Player software. The only thing that was wrong with it is it had been yellowed a bit. But I even did a video of restoring it back to its normal color with the whole de-yellowing process. So, yeah, like, it's in pretty much as good a shape as it could possibly be, minus, you know, the original box.
Were you tempted to sell it, or you figured, oh, this is a once-in-a-lifetime, you know, fine, I have to keep it?
I had no current plans to get rid of it. It was just one of these things, like, I have to save this. Kind of like what we talked about before with preservation. Like, I know what this thing is. I don't want, you know, it could potentially end up in some little kid's hands and he might have fun with it. But at the same time, it can end up in mine and I could just keep it safe. You know, because if there's really only 150 of these things and there's, like, one on eBay for $3,000, I don't know. It would have been silly to not buy it.
Yeah. That's what we all live for, those sort of deals. Absolutely. I'm looking at a box version right now in PlayAsia. It's not in stock, but oh man, imagine if it had the box too.
Ooh. Check.
Oh,
eBay.
And also, and the adapter was also white as well. The Game Boy adapter.
Yeah, the Game Boy player was white. Wow. And I think that was the only way to get the white Game Boy player because even the European white one didn't have that.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen that in person. Not even at Portland. I don't think I've seen one of these before.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. Ooh, beautiful. Good job finding that.
Thank you.
That's one of those once-in-a-lifetime finds. I'm still waiting for one of my in-the-wild finds like that, where you find something that rare. Like, my friends have found, like, yeah, found Magical Chase and a bunch of other Turbo games at a flea market, or found, you know, Little Samson and Dinosaur Peak for NES at a flea market. I've yet to come across that big find like that, at least for a game that's rare. It almost seems like I'll buy a game that's hard to find, and I might find it a year later at the swap meet for cheap. But it's never been where I was looking for something that was rarer than found it. Probably the biggest one, you'll probably laugh at this. For some reason at my swap meet, I found three box Samba de Amigos for your Dreamcast, the whole box. And it's like, yeah, you really don't find that too often, but I found probably two or three at my swap meet like in 6-7 years, which I always thought was funny. Because that's, you don't really find it too often. For some reason, they just sort of showed up.
Yeah, the North American controller for that was very, very limited. I think it was only sold through Electronics Boutique at the time.
Oh yeah, I found it multiple times out here. The North American one,
impressive.
I think the first time I found one was within the first year I moved here, and then another time I found one. With my friend, there was two of them. We both got one, and I pieced together the best condition one, and then sold the other one at a game convention for not that much. I don't think they go for that much, as far as I remember. This was a few years ago, but that was always something I thought was pretty funny. That when I moved out to San Diego, there were so many better the flea markets were so much healthier, let's just say, than they were back in New Jersey. So I was just finding more and more stuff. You know, I found a demo Atari 2600 games, not necessarily prototypes, but I found, you know, demo games, you know, like loaner copies that are only worth, they're probably worth like $100, $120, not that much, but at least I found them out here. Would never find that in New Jersey, for example. You know, I found like a, you know, box Atari Jaguar complete for like $20 when I first moved out here. This stuff that you not only don't find anymore, I wasn't even finding that stuff in New Jersey in 2005. It was just really tough to come across that stuff.
Well, probably also probably helps that a lot of those companies were actually based out here. Or, well, I say here as if I'm from California, but, you know, I'm in California at the moment. But a lot of video game companies are based on the West Coast, so a lot of their inventory just kind of got dumped into the state.
Sure. Also, I guess San Diego is more of a transient town. A lot of military, a lot of people moving back and forth. So maybe, you know, they get rid of their stuff. That might be something that have to do with it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Not a huge amount of people are from San Diego. Usually, you move here from somewhere, or you move out of here at some point. That might be part of it. But, you know, I, like I said before, I don't have a flea markets are in Chicago, but out here they're not dead, but they're not as healthy as they were. And so I maybe go once a month, and I used to go every week. It used to be that if I didn't go, I felt like a nervous tick that I was missing out on some sort of deal, because I was. If I wasn't going, I knew there was some sort of score I was not getting. You know, but that sort of subsided. Probably helped working on a certain NES guidebook probably helped that, because I had to stay home and write. But eventually I sort of got over. It was like kicking a nicotine habit, so to speak. At some point I was like, oh, it was easier and easier, you know, not to go to the swap meet. So at this point when I go, it purely is more for fun. If I miss out on a deal, it's not like I'm kicking myself, you know, at this point. Because I found, even though I haven't found like the, you know, a gold mine like you did with that console, I found my fair share of good stuff still. I really can't complain about the stuff I've found. You know, like Atari Lynx consoles with like 20 games in the case for like, you know, $25, you know, stuff like that. I've found my fair share of goodies out there.
That's pretty impressive. The swap scene in Chicago is not very good, to be honest with you. The best place in the United States I've ever found for retro games is the Seattle area, actually, just because of the amount of stores that exist there and the fact that like both Nintendo and Microsoft are there. And like,
oh, sure.
There's so much like Nintendo oddities especially pop up there all the time.
The employees that took stuff?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
They quit? Yeah.
Exactly. This isn't totally relevant, but you were talking about Samba de Amigo and we were talking about Japan. Did you know that Sega released a spiritual sequel to that game only in Japan and only on the PS1? Like, after they were done with consoles, they made a PS1 game.
No.
No, it's called Mini Moni Shaker and Tambourine Dapayon. I had to look that up just to be sure of the title, but I own the game. But when I was out in Japan, I actually found like the maracas set for it, and I wanted to buy it like so bad because it was like, you know, it was like 700 yen, which is like $6. And I was like, oh man, I want this, but there was no physical way that I could put it in my suitcase. It's huge, and I was just I know, I had to let it go. But that's another thing that kills you about Japan is like you have to be very particular about what you pick up because of all the space that it takes, and you're limited to your suitcase basically unless you cheat and start mailing stuff. But yeah, so in that case, I just found it amazing that that existed, and that's just a perfect example of how Japan could screw with you if you ever go over there, man. I pity you.
Yeah, it's almost going to be, you almost don't want to, because you're, like you said, you're going to see stuff that, you know, where you don't, I guess that's the thing with retro game collecting. It's like anything else. There's a lot of things you don't want until you see it. And then it's like, oh, now you're leaving it behind. Did you ever end up getting that game? Did you ever buy it on eBay, or you just never got it?
I have the I have like the actual game with the original case and everything. I just don't have like the controller for it.
Okay.
Yeah, the controller is what I found over there, and I really wanted to pick it up, but just because it was a weird piece of Sega hardware made for the PlayStation 1, you know, it's like they made two games for the PS1, that and they ported over Puyo Puyo Sun at one point, and so I got both of those as more of a Sega guy. I just liked the idea that they had actually made two games for the PS1, but to think that Sega produced a controller as well, I want that, but space.
Yeah, well, it looks like the controller doesn't go for that much, so you can you'll pay more for shipping than the actual piece of merchandise, which is often, unfortunately, the case, right?
Yeah, oh yeah.
It used to be that maybe not anymore, but you could get a PC Engine for like $20, but to ship it was $40 or $50.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you see, so unless you were bundling up like 20 different things, it wasn't worth to get it. You know, that's just the way it is. So people out there, don't complain about the price to ship my book overseas, for God's sake. You know, it costs a lot to ship stuff across an ocean. Did you go to any of the cool arcades over there when you were in Japan?
Yeah, a little bit. Not so much. I mean, the things I actually focused more on was, like, so Sega has these, like, big buildings over there that just have, like, giant Capsule Toys machines in them. And, like, we're talking, like, huge machines. And it's actually really easy to win figures in there. And then, like, every floor either has capsule machines or arcade stuff. And it's weird because there's almost no employees who work in there. Like, maybe there'll be one person for the entire building. It's strange. And then it's always open. People just go in. And I was more, like, floored by its existence than anything else. And they were just everywhere. You just kept going in and be like, wow, there's an entire unoccupied arcade right here. This is strange.
No one's there to get out of work. They also have a lot of the, I guess it's basically legalized gambling, where they have, I guess, the pachinko machines, and you get trinkets that you trade in for prizes, or how does that work? It's not
actually
exactly gambling.
I never actually ran into those, so I'm not totally sure. I was surprised, too, because the way I've been told is like, oh, yeah, Sega, like 90% of their income is pachinko machines now. I'm like, all right, so I should see those everywhere, but I never saw one. So I can't say. But yeah, you're right. I thought I would see that too.
Yeah, it's the same with Konami, where they make a ton of money off of like slot machines and gambling machines at this point. So it's almost like, by their perspective, well, we're guaranteed to make a ton of money doing this. Screw this game development thing. You know, that's sort of old hat at this point. Hate to say it. So what do you got? What do you got going on down the line besides seeing me in New Jersey?
I guess I'm going to an event tomorrow for South Park Fractured But Whole, and then I see you. Then I'll actually be back here for a completely different thing. I mean, back in San Francisco. And that's just the stuff I know right now, schedule-wise. I'm also, as always, going to be producing more videos for my channel. I actually have a bunch done all the way through, like, November.
Really? You have them all in the can?
Either a bunch of them are, or a bunch are at least listed, and I know what I have to do. You know what I mean? Like, I plan it out. And then my other channels, Game Society specifically, is... We're always working on other stuff. You know, there's all sorts of gameplay videos and stuff we pop over there. We try to do a lot of early access things with more modern day games. Then we do, you know, monthly live streams, which I do myself. I do live streams on my channel all the time, but they're like live Q&As where people just come and they basically just talk to me for a while. But the thing that make them, I guess, interesting is that I usually go for like 4 or 5 hours.
Five hours of Q&A.
Yeah. Literally last night I did one at the hotel in Seattle for like 4 hours and 10 minutes. My all-time record is 5 hours and 40 minutes.
What the hell, dude? Holy crap. No break? Woo!
I try not to. I did actually take a pee break during the one yesterday, and I apologize to the audience because I was just like, that's very unprofessional, and I know it. But I always ask them ahead of time.
It's unprofessional.
It's unprofessional. I ask them if it's okay. Can I go pee? And like, if they say no, then I would stay. But if they say yes, and they always do, then I run off, and I try to put something interesting on the screen for a second while I run off and pee as fast as possible and then run back. But I've only ever had to do that like twice. Usually I just sit there the entire time and power through it.
What have you thought about over the years, how you've seen YouTube change? Has it gone in a direction that you agree with? Is it sort of, well, it's corporate, it's to be expected? Is it an unfortunate in your eyes how YouTube has evolved with the adpocalypse and, you know, now with the copyright claims on videos beefing up?
I have felt for about a year now that YouTube has tried to take the U out of YouTube. They've obviously pushed for more corporate content, as you point out, and Adpocalypse has really kind of cemented that. We're to the point where a lot of YouTubers who are just kind of doing it for fun are just like even less motivated to make content, and those of us who depend on it as a job, a lot of them have given up and have started just doing other things, and those of us who are still here are really struggling. For the most part anyway, depending on what your type of content is. So like one of my channels has been hit very, very hard. My channel, my own personal one, has not been hit as hard because it doesn't deal in anything other than discussion for the most part, which YouTube likes. But, you know, gameplay videos that feature video games of people shooting each other, the system can't tell the difference between that and like an ISIS video. So it's, you know, it's all violent, therefore it must be bad. I don't like that, but at the same time, YouTube is significantly understaffed, and they don't really have a mechanism in place to try and fix that. So, like, I want to complain, but at the same time, I don't have a solution for them, you know? I think it started off as more of a pet project or more of a fun thing, and now it's become too big for its own good, in a sense.
Well, it's always going to be the choice of, you say there's no more you and YouTube, where it's going away. Well, they're never going to stop people from putting up the videos they want to. It's just whether or not they're going to be monetized.
Yeah.
You know, are people going to be able to earn money from them? So that's a natural progression of the business, where I think that now, you know, with the corporations really wondering about where their advertiser dollars are going. I saw this coming for at least a couple of years. I just didn't think it would happen this suddenly, you know, and with this haphazard of design. I thought they would have eased into this a little bit more thoroughly than, well, a ton of companies are pulling out. Now all of a sudden we got to throw together this machine learning and throw together these new systems. You would think that a company like Google would have saw this coming and would have prepared for it a little bit better. That's what was the most shocking to me. Not that it happened, any of this. I thought it was bound to happen. It's just that how it went from, oh, everything's fine, right? Everyone's, you know, ads in front of any type of video you can want, even though an advertiser might agree to. Oh, no, now advertisers are coming down on us because there's no controls in place at all. You know, they thought somehow that they can get away with treating YouTube and online videos separately than all other forms of entertainment where advertisers have control over where their dollars are placed. I just thought that the honeymoon was going to end. I just didn't see it ending quite like this, where, you know, it sort of was like, oh, a cat's out of the bag. You know, so that was the most surprising part to me, where they put themselves in a position to have a quote-unquote adpocalypse and didn't think it thoroughly more. Up to that point, that there was going to be a tipping point where all the advertisers were going to wonder what the hell's going on. So, but I think it's going to even out, and I think we're starting to see that. And there's always going to be bumps along the way. I was affected a little bit. I had some videos demonetized I wasn't aware of, but in the past, I mean, I've had ones questionably taken down, or not taken down, but copyright claimed by even Nintendo for like an old Flea Market Madness where I use like a Super Mario Brothers 2 song in the background for like 30 seconds, for example. Mm-hmm. And so I haven't made money off of that video for years. So, you know, I look at it as, you know, I have to sort of, you know, roll with the punches, so to speak, when it comes to this stuff. I think it's the best you can do. You know,
any YouTuber. That's what we all have to do.
There's not much recourse. And plus, I think, you know, the YouTuber, if they can see what's coming, they can diversify sort of their online portfolio, whatever the else they have going on. Maybe do some Twitch, you know, as an avenue. I have to get into that myself. I really don't have the time. Or, you know, maybe someone writes a book, or they do music, or they do something else. They may, you know, do T-shirts to sort of supplement the ad revenue that's disappeared.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, lately a lot of compensation has come from the form of viewers through things like PayPal donations, Super Chat, Patreon, all that kind of stuff. And it sucks to have to kind of lean on that. It makes you feel like an asshole, but like at the same time, like, you know, you got to eat too.
Well, I would think that, you know, the people that genuinely like you and they watch your content, you know, several times a week or almost daily, some will be like, hey, maybe I should, you know, show some sort of compensation or some sort of form of graciousness for this person. Like someone like you beating themselves up working 6-7 days a week for 8 years. Ugh. You know, it's almost like a small price to pay, right?
I would like to think so.
I hate the term. I'm glad to see that finally people have sort of come off the wall, or come off the, you know, people are ready to come after us with pitchforks when Patreon first started up.
Oh, I know. When I did my video announcing it, people were like, fucking kill him. And I was just like, all right, dude, sorry.
Or if you did even a single brand video like 4 or 5 years ago, people were ready to have your head. And now they're like, well, it's sort of necessary for some of these guys to, you know, survive, or at least be able to do it as much as they want to. Like, if I didn't have some sort of compensation from, for example, on the podcast, having some sort of sponsors, then the podcast doesn't really make much. And then it's like, not that you're going to stop doing it, but it gives you a better incentive to do it if you know you're being compensated as well. You know, yeah. Like if you can involve more people to be involved with it, you can spread the love around, you know, you can have some sort of higher production value, you can buy new equipment. I mean, you know how it goes.
Yeah, I do. And that's what I always tell people is like, if I could do anything, I would be doing what I'm doing. But the reality of the world we live in is you need money to do things on a day-to-day basis. So if I can't make money doing what I'm doing, I have to stop doing it and do other things. That's just how reality works. So don't assume I'm only doing this for money and no other reason. Like, I want to do this regardless. I just can't necessarily do that, much like I'm sure you couldn't.
Yeah, it's like asking an actor working on, you know, the Avengers, Infinity Wars. Would you still do this if you weren't paid anything? How many actors say, sure, I would do that? I would give up 4 months of my life to work on this for nothing. You know, versus, yeah, this is enjoyable. I'm having the time of my life, but yes, I should be compensated for my effort at least as well.
Yeah.
You know, it's at some point, you have to look at that side of it, at least in my opinion.
I agree with you.
Speaking of that, do you see yourself doing this for, you know, 10 years from now, 20 years from now? I like to ask this of my guests. Do you see yourself getting into more behind-the-scenes stuff, producing? Where do you see your future lying?
To be honest, I want to do this as long as I possibly can, but it's always good to have some sort of fallback. And I've thought about those kinds of options, whether it would be to continue that original film career pursuit, which there is an avenue, though I'm not currently at liberty to discuss what it is. There's also the possibility of just working in the gaming industry itself. Through all the stuff I do, I've made a lot of friends at various video game companies, and I kind of feel like if I really wanted to, I could probably get a job working at some place like that. But I don't want to do any of those things. I want to be doing what I'm doing. But it's good to have plan B, C, D, E, F, you know, and so on. So
what would you want to do if you had to get into game development? What would you want to do?
Oh, if I had to work in like the actual gaming industry as opposed to the media side of things, I would probably want to do public relations stuff.
Okay.
More so, I'm not a game developer. Like, I never had programming skills. Maybe part of me would be interested in, you know, the storytelling aspect of it. But I kind of feel like I would rather just do the human communication.
Do the social media stuff.
Essentially, yeah. I'd rather, because that's kind of what I've gotten good at through the nature of this job. So I feel like that's where my skills would be best used, as opposed to being another cook in the kitchen and saying, like, no, I have a really good idea for a story or a game, when, you know, they got plenty of people who can do that as well. But at the same time, that sounds a little weird, considering that my next best choice would be to do something more involved in film, which would be storytelling. So, like I said, that's why they're all plan B through F, you know? Like, I think less about them because I want to have fallbacks, but I don't want to prioritize my fallbacks, if that makes sense.
You heard it here first. Adam's going to be directing episode 9. You heard the director dropped out.
Dude, we talked about this before the stream. You were not supposed to bring that up. Bleep all of this.
Adam, where can people find you on YouTube and Twitter?
You can find me on YouTube at youtube.com/AdamKorlick, AdamKorlick. You can also look up Adam Korlick on Twitter. You can look it up on Facebook. I've got all that stuff. You can also, if you want to do the comedy route, you can look up youtube.com/GameSocietyPimps. That's where we do all the comedy stuff with celebrity impressions and all those kinds of things. And I also appear on Blame Society Films and Machinima.
You can tell he's good at social media. He had it all down, like ready to go, like clockwork.
Thank you.
Thanks so much, Adam, for coming on the podcast. We should do this again in the future. Talk about more esoteric Dreamcast items.
Yeah, that'd be great, man. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks again to Adam for speaking to me this week. Before we get going, let me tell you about That's It Veggie Bars. You remember That's It Fruit Bars? They have fruit and that's it. I don't know how they've done it before, which we spoke about on the CU podcast with Ian. Incredible bars. It defies the laws of gravity and nature. Well, they're back. That's It Veggie Bars. They got stuff like black beans and carrots, black beans and peas, black beans and corn. It's a healthy snack, 90 calories, all natural ingredients. It's good on the go. Keep one in your car, in your purse, if you happen to have a purse. I don't have a purse, but you might. Your backpack, what have you. When you're out at the swap meet or flea market, you want a nice, healthy snack. That's It Veggie. That's right. That's It Veggie. Proud sponsor now, the Not So Common Podcast. Go to thatsitfruit.com, enter code NOTCOMMON, and save 10% off any order today on That's It Veggie or That's It Fruit. Yeah, on the go. You know, I want to throw a veggie in my mouth, but I don't have an ear of corn near me. Well, have That's It black beans and corn. It's almost like eating a full ear of corn. You got 4 grams of veggie protein. You got fiber, non-GMO, non-preservative, no fat. And hell no, there's no gluten here. No gluten. And they're all under 100 calories. You can keep that trim figure. Again, That's It Veggie Bars. Go to That's it for .com. Enter code NOTCOMMON and save 10% on any order today. Tell them Pat sent you. That's it for this Not-So-Common podcast. If you enjoyed the podcast, please subscribe on your podcast platform of choice, Stitcher, iTunes, Podbean, Google Play, or wherever you listen to these podcasts. Please do that. You can rate the podcast. You can leave a comment to help give it a boost and spread the word on your social media, Facebook, your Instagram, your Snapchat, your Twitter, your MySpace, if you still have that. Let others know how much you enjoy it. Finally, if you want to help directly support me and the Not So Common Podcast, please check out patreon.com/patcountry. Thanks, and I'll see you next time.